free. It was not much noticed that, again from around 1970, a similar crisis had begun to undermine the second world of the centrally planned economies. It was first concealed, later underlined, by the inflexibility of their political systems, so that the change, when it came, was sudden, as in the late 1970s, after the death of Mao in China, and in 1983 to 1985, after the death of Brezhnev in the USSR. Economically, it was clear from the middle 1960s that centrally state-planned socialism badly needed reform. From the 1970s on, there were strong signs of actual regression. This was the very moment when these economies were exposed, like everyone else, even if perhaps not to the same extent, to the uncontrollable movements and unpredictable fluctuations of the transnational world economy. The massive entry of the USSR on the international grain market and the impact of the oil crises of the 1970s dramatized the end of the socialist camp as a virtually self-contained regional economy protected from the vagaries of the world economy. East and West were curiously bonded together not only by the transnational economy, which neither could control, but by the strange interdependence of the Cold War power system. This, as we have seen, stabilized both superpowers and the world between them, and was in turn to throw both into disorder when it collapsed. The disorder was not merely political, but economic. For with the sudden collapse of the Soviet political system, the interregional division of labor and the network of mutual dependence which had developed in the Soviet sphere also collapsed, forcing countries and regions that were geared to it to come to terms singly with a world market for which they were not equipped. But the West was equally unprepared to integrate the remains of the old communist parallel world system into its own world market, even when it wanted to, as the European community did not. Finland, one of the spectacular economic success stories of post-war Europe, was plunged into a major slump by the collapse of the Soviet economy. Germany, the greatest economic power of Europe, was to impose tremendous strains on its own economy and on Europe as a whole simply because its government, against warnings by its bankers, it must be said, completely underestimated the difficulty and costs of absorbing a relatively tiny part of the socialist economy, the 16-million-strong German Democratic Republic. These, however, were unpredicted consequences of the Soviet breakup, which almost nobody expected until it actually happened. Nevertheless, in the meantime, as in the West, unthinkable thoughts became thinkable in the East. Invisible problems became visible. Thus, in both East and West, the defense of the environment became an important campaigning issue in the 1970s, whether the issue was the defense of Wales or the preservation of Lake Baikal in Siberia. Given the restrictions on public debate, we cannot exactly trace the development of critical thoughts in these societies, but by 1980, first-class and formally reforming communist economists within the regime, like Janos Kornay in Hungary, were publishing notably negative analyses of the socialist economic systems, and the ruthless probes into the defects of the Soviet social system, which became known in the mid-80s, had clearly been long gestating among the academics of Novosibirsk and elsewhere. When leading communists actually gave up their belief in socialism is even harder to establish, for after 1989 to 1991, such people had some interest in retrospectively antedating their conversion. What was true in economics was even more patently true in politics, as Gorbachev's perestroika was to show, at any rate in the Western socialist countries. With all their historic admiration for and attachment to Lenin, there is little doubt that many reform communists would have wanted to abandon much of the political heritage of Leninism, though few, outside the Italian Communist Party, to which reformers in the East felt attracted, were prepared to say so. What most reformers in the socialist world would have wanted was to transform communism into something like Western social democracy. Stockholm was their model rather than Los Angeles. There is no sign that Hayek and Friedman had many secret admirers in Moscow or Budapest. It was their bad luck that the crisis of the communist systems coincided with the crisis of Golden Age capitalism, which was also the crisis of social democratic systems. It was their even worse luck that the sudden collapse of communism made a program of gradual transformation appear both undesirable and impractical, and that it occurred when the root and branch radicalism of the pure free market ideologists was, briefly, triumphant in the capitalist West. This, therefore, became the theoretical inspiration of post-communist regimes, though in practice it proved as unrealizable there as anywhere else. However, though in many ways the crises in East and West ran parallel and were linked into a single global crisis by both politics and economics, they differed in two major respects. For the communist system, which at least in the Soviet sphere was inflexible and inferior, it was a matter of life and death, which it did not survive. Survival of the economic system was never at issue in the developed countries of capitalism, and, in spite of the crumbling of their political systems, neither as yet was the viability of these systems. This may explain, though it cannot justify, the implausible claim by an American writer that, with the end of communism, the future history of humanity would be that of liberal democracy. Only in one vital respect were these systems at risk. Their future existence as single territorial states was no longer guaranteed. However, in the early 1990s, not a single one of the Western nation states threatened with secessionist movements had actually broken up. During the age of catastrophe, the end of capitalism had seemed near. The Great Slump could be described, like the title of a contemporary book, as This Final Crisis. Few were seriously apocalyptic about the immediate future of developed capitalism, although a French historian and art dealer firmly predicted the end of Western civilization in 1976 on the not untenable ground that the momentum of the US economy, which had carried the rest of the capitalist world forward in the past, was now a spent force. He therefore expected the current depression to continue well into the next millennium. It is only fair to add that, until the middle or even late 1980s, few were apocalyptic about the prospects of the USSR either. However, precisely because of the greater and more uncontrollable dynamism of the capitalist economy, the social texture of Western societies had been far more profoundly undermined than that of socialist ones, and consequently, in this respect, the crisis of the West was more severe. The social fabric of the USSR and Eastern Europe went to pieces as a result of the system's collapse and not as a precondition of it. Where comparisons were possible, as between West and East Germany, it seemed that the values and habits of traditional Germany had been better preserved under the lid of communism than in the Western region of economic miracles. The Jewish emigrants from the USSR to Israel revived the classical music scene there, since they came from a country where going to live concerts was still a normal part of cultured behaviour, at any rate for Jews. The concert public had not yet been reduced, in effect, to a small and mainly middle-aged or elderly minority. The inhabitants of Moscow and Warsaw were less worried by what troubled those of New York or London, a visibly rising crime rate, public insecurity, and the unpredictable violence of anomic youths. There was obviously little public flaunting of the kind of behaviour which outraged the socially conservative or conventional, even in the West, who saw it as evidence of the breakdown of civilization and darkly muttered, Weimar. How much of this difference between East and West was due to the greater wealth of Western societies and the far more rigid control of the state in the East is difficult to establish. In some respects, East and West had evolved in the same direction. In both, families became smaller, marriages broke up more freely than elsewhere, the populations of states, or at any rate of their more urbanized and industrialized regions, reproduced themselves barely if at all. In both, so far as we can tell, the hold of traditional Western religions was drastically weakened, although it was claimed by religious inquirers that there was a revival of religious belief in post-Soviet Russia, though not in religious attendance. As events after 1989 showed, Polish women became as reluctant to let the Catholic Church dictate their mating habits as Italian women, although in the communist era, Poles had shown a passionate attachment to the Church on nationalist and anti-Soviet grounds. Plainly, the communist regimes provided less social space for subcultures, countercultures, and underworlds of all kinds, and repressed dissidents. Moreover, peoples which had passed through the periods of genuinely ruthless and wholesale terror, which studied the history of most such states, were likely to keep their heads down even when the exercise of power became gentler. Nevertheless, the relative tranquility of socialist life was not due to fear. The system insulated its citizens from the full impact of the Western social transformations because it insulated them from the full impact of Western capitalism. what change they underwent came through the state or through their response to the state. What the state did not set out to change stayed much as it had been before. The paradox of communism in power was that it was conservative. 4. About the vast area of the Third World, including those parts of it which were now industrializing, it is hardly possible to generalize. Insofar as its problems can be surveyed as a whole, I have tried to do this in chapters 7 and 12. The crisis decades, as we have seen, affected its regions in very different ways. How are we to compare South Korea, where the ownership of television sets went from 6.4% of the population to 99.1% in the 15 years from 1970 to 1985, with a country like Peru, where over half the population was below the poverty line, more than in 1972, and the per capita consumption was falling, let alone with the ravaged countries of sub-Saharan Africa? The tensions within a subcontinent, like India, were those of a growing economy and a society in transformation. Those in areas like Somalia, Angola, and Liberia were those of countries in dissolution, in a continent about whose future few are optimistic. Only one generalization was fairly safe. Since 1970, almost all the countries in this region had plunged deeply into debt. In 1990, they ranged from the three giants of international debt, $60 to $110 billion, Brazil, Mexico, and Argentina, through the other 28 who owed over $10 billion each, down to the minnows who owed a billion or two. The World Bank, which had reason to know, counted only 7 among the 96 low- and middle-income economies it monitored who had external debts substantially below $1 billion, countries like Lesotho and Chad, and even these were many times as large as they had been 20 years earlier. In 1970, there had been only 12 countries with a debt over $1 billion, and none with debts over $10 billion. In more realistic terms, by 1980, 6 countries had a debt virtually as large as their entire GNP, or bigger. 1990, 24 countries owed more than they produced, including, taking the region as a whole, all of sub-Saharan Africa. The relatively most heavily indebted countries were not surprisingly to be found in Africa: Mozambique, Tanzania, Somalia, Zambia, Congo, the Ivory Coast, some disrupted by war, some by the collapse of the price of their exports. However, the countries which had to bear the heaviest cost of servicing these vast debts, that is to say, where this amounted to a quarter or more of the country's total exports, were more evenly spread. Indeed, among the regions of the world, sub-Saharan Africa was rather below this figure, better off in this respect than South Asia, Latin America and the Caribbean, and the Middle East. Practically, none of this money was ever likely to be repaid, but so long as the banks continued to earn interest on it, an average of 9.6% in 1982, they did not mind. There was a moment of genuine panic in the early 1980s when, starting with Mexico, the major Latin American debtors could no longer pay, and the Western banking system was on the verge of collapse, since several of the largest banks had lent their money with such abandon in the 1970s, when the petrodollars flooded in, clamoring for investment, that they would now be technically bankrupt. Fortunately for the economy of the rich countries, the three Latin giants of debt failed to act together. Separate arrangements for rescheduling the debts were made, and the banks, supported by governments and international agencies, had time in which gradually to write off their lost assets and to maintain technical solvency. The debt crisis remained, but was no longer potentially fatal. This was probably the most dangerous moment for the capitalist world economy since 1929. Its full story has not yet been written. While their debts mounted, the assets or potential assets of the poor states did not. The capitalist world economy, which judges exclusively by profit or potential profit, clearly decided to write off a large part of the Third World in the crisis decades. Of the 42 low-income economies in 1970, 19 had zero net foreign investments. In 1990, direct foreign investors had lost total interest in 26. Indeed, there was substantial investment, more than $500 million, in only 14 out of almost 100 low- and middle-income countries outside Europe, and massive investment, from about $1 billion or so upwards, in only 8, of which 4 were in East and Southeast Asia: China, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and 3 in Latin America: Argentina, Mexico, Brazil. The increasingly integrated transnational world economy did not entirely overlook the outcast regions. The smaller and more scenic among them had potential as tourist paradises and offshore refuges from government control, and the discovery of some suitable resource on some hitherto uninteresting territory might well change the situation. However, on the whole, a large part of the world was dropping out of the world economy. After the collapse of the Soviet bloc, this also looked like being the case with the area between Trieste and Vladivostok. In 1990, the only former socialist states of Eastern Europe which attracted any net foreign investment were Poland and Czechoslovakia. Within the vast area of the former USSR, there were clearly resource-rich districts or republics which attracted serious money, and zones which were left to their own miserable devices. One way or another, most of the former Second World was being assimilated to Third World status. The main effect of the crisis decades was thus to widen the gap between rich and poor countries. The real GDP per capita of sub-Saharan Africa declined from 14% of that of the industrial countries to 8% between 1960 and 1987. That of the least developed countries, which included both African and non-African countries, from 9% to 5%. 5. As the transnational economy established its grip over the world, it undermined a major and, since 1945, virtually universal institution, the territorial nation-state, since such a state could no longer control more than a diminishing part of its affairs. Organizations whose field of action was effectively bounded by the frontiers of their territory, like trade unions, parliaments, and national public broadcasting systems, therefore lost, as organizations not so bounded, like transnational firms, the international currency market, and the globalized media and communications of the satellite era, gained. The disappearance of the superpowers, which could at any rate control their satellite states, was to reinforce this tendency. Even the most irreplaceable function nation-states had developed during the century, that of redistributing their income among their populations through the transfer payments of the welfare, educational and health services and other fund allocations, could no longer be territorially self-contained in theory, though most of it had to remain so in practice, except where supranational entities like the European Community or Union supplemented it in some respects. During the heyday of the free market theologians, the state was further undermined by the tendency to dismantle activities hitherto conducted by public bodies on principle, leaving them to the market. Paradoxically, but perhaps not surprisingly, this weakening of the nation-state went with a new fashion for cutting up the old territorial nation-states into what claimed to be smaller, new ones, mostly based on the demand of some group to ethnic-linguistic monopoly. To begin with, the rise of such autonomous and separatist movements, mainly after 1970, was primarily a Western phenomenon, observable in Britain, Spain, Canada, Belgium, even in Switzerland and Denmark, but also from the early 1970s in the least centralized of socialist states, Yugoslavia. The crisis of communism spread it to the east, where more new and nominally national states were to be formed after 1991 than at any other time during the 20th century. Until the 1990s, it left the Western Hemisphere, south of the Canadian border, virtually unaffected. In the areas where the 1980s and 1990s brought the collapse and disintegration of states, as in Afghanistan and parts of Africa, the alternative to the old state was not so much a partition into new states as anarchy. The development was paradoxical, since it was perfectly plain that the new mini-nation states suffered from precisely the same drawbacks as the older ones, only being smaller, more so. It was less surprising than it seemed, simply because the only actual state model available in the late 20th century was that of the bounded territory with its own autonomous institutions, in short, the nation-state model of the Age of Revolution. Moreover, since 1918, all regimes had been committed to the principle of national self-determination, which had been increasingly defined in ethnic-linguistic terms. In this respect, Lenin and President Wilson were at one. Both the Europe of the Versailles Peace Treaties and what became the USSR were conceived of as collections of such nation-states. In the case of the USSR and Yugoslavia, which later followed its example, these were unions of such states which, however in theory, though not in practice, retained their right to secession. When such unions broke up, it would naturally be along the predetermined fracture lines. However, in fact, the new separatist nationalism of the crisis decades was quite a different phenomenon from the nation-state creation of the 19th and early 20th century. It was indeed a combination of three phenomena. One was the resistance of existing nation-states against their demotion. This became increasingly clear in the 1980s with the attempts by members or potential members of the European community, sometimes of widely differing political complexions, like Norway and Mrs. Thatcher's Britain, to retain their regional autonomy within the all-European standardisation in matters which they thought important. However, it was significant that the main traditional prop of nation-state self-defence, namely protectionism, was incomparably weaker in the crisis decades than it had been in the age of catastrophe. Global free trade remained the ideal, and, to a surprising extent, the reality, more so than ever after the fall of the state-command economies, even though several states developed unacknowledged methods for protecting themselves against foreign competition. The Japanese and the French were said to be expert at this, but probably the Italians' success in keeping a lion's share of their home market for automobiles in Italian hands, that is to say, Fiat, was the most striking. Nevertheless, these were rearguard actions, though increasingly hard-fought and sometimes successful ones. They were probably contested most bitterly where the issue was not simply economic, but one of cultural identity. The French, and to a lesser extent the Germans, fought to maintain the vast subsidies for their peasants, not only because farmers had vital votes, but also because they genuinely felt that the destruction of peasant farming, however inefficient or uncompetitive, would mean the destruction of a landscape, a tradition, a part of the nation's character. The French, supported by the other Europeans, resisted the US demand for free trade in films and audiovisual products, not simply because this would have swamped their public and private screens with American products, since an American-based, though by now internationally owned and controlled, entertainment industry had re-established a potential world monopoly on the scale of the old Hollywood power. They also and justly felt that it was intolerable that pure calculations of comparative costs and profitability should lead to the end of film production in the French language. Whatever the economic arguments, there were things in life which had to be protected. Would any government seriously consider tearing down Chartres Cathedral or the Taj Mahal if it could be shown that building a luxury hotel, shopping mall and conference centre on the site, assuming it were to be sold to private buyers, would make a greater net addition to the country's GNP than could be yielded by the existing tourist traffic? The question has only to be formulated to be answered. The second is best described as the collective egoism of wealth and reflected the growing economic disparities within continents, countries and regions. Old-fashioned nation-state governments, centralised or federal, as well as supranational entities like the European Community, had accepted responsibility for developing their entire territories and therefore, to some extent, for equalising burdens and benefits across the whole of them. This meant that the poorer and more backward regions were subsidised via some central distributive mechanism by the richer and more advanced, or even given preference in investment in order to diminish their lag. The European Community was realistic enough only to admit states to membership whose backwardness and poverty would not put too great a strain on the rest, a realism totally absent from the North American Free Trade Area of 1993, which yoked the USA and Canada, 1990 GNP per capita of about $20,000, with Mexico and one-eighth of this per capita GNP. The reluctance of rich areas to subsidize poorer ones had long been familiar to students of local government, especially in the USA. The problem of the inner city, inhabited by the poor and with a tax base shrinking because of the flight to the suburbs, was largely due to this. Who wanted to pay for the poor? Rich suburbs in Los Angeles like Santa Monica and Malibu opted out of the city, and in the early 1990s, Staten Island voted to secede from New York for the same reason. Some of the separatist nationalism of the crisis decades plainly fed on this collective egoism. The pressure for breaking up Yugoslavia came from European Slovenia and Croatia, and for splitting Czechoslovakia from the vociferously Western Czech Republic. Catalonia and the Basque Country were the wealthiest and most developed parts of Spain, and the only signs of significant separatism in Latin America came from the richest state of Brazil, Rio Grande do Sul. The purest example of this phenomenon was the sudden rise in the late 1980s of the Lombard League, later Northern League, which aimed at the secession of the region centered on Milan, the economic capital of Italy, from Rome, the political capital. The rhetoric of the League, with its references to a glorious medieval past and the Lombard dialect, was the usual one of nationalist agitation, but the real issue was the rich region's wish to keep its resources to itself. The third element was perhaps chiefly a response to the Cultural Revolution of the second half of the century, that extraordinary dissolution of traditional social norms, textures and values, which left so many of the inhabitants of the developed world orphaned and bereft. Never was the word community used more indiscriminately and emptily than in the decades when communities, in the sociological sense, became hard to find in real life. The intelligence community, the public relations community, the gay community. The rise of identity groups, human ensembles to which a person could belong, unequivocally and beyond uncertainty and doubt, was noted from the late 1960s by writers in the always self-observing USA. Most of these, for obvious reasons, appealed to a common ethnicity, although other groups of people seeking collective separatism used the same nationalist language, as when homosexual activists spoke of the queer nation. As the emergence of this phenomenon in the most systematically multi-ethnic of states suggests, the politics of identity groups had no intrinsic connection with the national self-determination, that is to say, the desire to create territorial states identical with a particular people, which was the essence of nationalism. Secession made no sense for US Negroes or Italians, nor was it part of their ethnic politics. Ukrainian politics in Canada were not Ukrainian but Canadian. Indeed, the essence of ethnic or similar politics in urban, that is to say, almost by definition, heterogeneous societies, was to compete with other such groups for a share of the resources of the non-ethnic state by using the political leverage of group loyalty. The politicians elected for the New York municipal constituencies, gerrymandered in order to provide specific representation for Latino, Oriental, and homosexual voting blocs, wanted more out of New York City, not less. What ethnic identity politics had in common with fin de siècle ethnic nationalism was the insistence that one group's identity consisted in some existential, supposedly primordial, unchangeable, and therefore permanent personal characteristic shared with other members of the group and with no one else. Exclusiveness was all the more essential to it, since the actual differences which marked human communities off from each other were attenuated. Young American Jews searched for their roots when the things which stamped them indelibly as Jews were no longer effective markers of Jewry, not least the segregation and discrimination of the years before the Second World War. Though Quebec nationalism insisted on separation because it claimed to be a distinct society, it actually emerged as a significant force precisely when Quebec ceased to be the distinct society it had so patently and unmistakably been until the 1960s. The very fluidity of ethnicity in urban societies made its choice as the only criterion of the group arbitrary and artificial. In the USA, except for blacks, Hispanics, and those of English and German origins, at least 60% of American-born women of all ethnic origins married outside their group. Increasingly, one's identity had to be constructed by insisting on the non-identity of others. How otherwise could the neo-Nazi skinheads in Germany, wearing the uniforms, hairstyles, and musical tastes of the cosmopolitan youth culture, establish their essential Germanness except by beating up local Turks and Albanians? How, except by eliminating those who did not belong, could the essentially Croat or Serb character of some region be established, in which, for most of history, a variety of ethnicities and religions had lived as neighbours? The tragedy of this exclusionary identity politics, whether or not it set out to establish independent states, was that it could not possibly work. It could only pretend to. The Italian-Americans from Brooklyn, who perhaps increasingly insisted on their Italianness and talked to one another in Italian, apologizing for their lack of fluency in what they supposed to be their native tongue, worked in an American economy to which Italianness as such was irrelevant, except as a key to a relatively modest niche market. The pretense that there was a black or Hindu or Russian or female truth incomprehensible and therefore essentially incommunicable to those outside the group could not survive outside institutions whose only function was to encourage such views. Islamic fundamentalists who studied physics did not study Islamic physics. Jewish engineers did not learn Hasidic engineering. Even the most culturally nationalist Frenchmen or Germans learned that operating in the global village of the scientists and technical experts who made the world work required communication in a single global language analogous to medieval Latin, which happened to be based on English. Even a world divided into theoretically homogeneous ethnic territories by genocide, mass expulsion, and ethnic cleansing were inevitably heterogenized again by mass movements of people. Workers, tourists, businessmen, technicians, of styles and by the tentacles of the global economy. That, after all, is what happened to the countries of Central Europe, ethnically cleansed during and after the Second World War. That is what would inevitably happen again in an increasingly urbanized world. Identity politics and fantasy-ecle nationalism were thus not so much programs, still less effective programs for dealing with the problems of the late 20th century, but rather emotional reactions to these problems. And yet, as the century drew to its end, the absence of institutions and mechanisms actually capable of dealing with these problems became increasingly evident. The nation-state was no longer capable of dealing with them. Who or what was? Various devices have been invented for this purpose since the United Nations had been set up in 1945, on the assumption, immediately disappointed, that USA and USSR would continue to agree sufficiently to take global decisions. About the best that could be said for this organization is that, unlike its predecessor, the League of Nations, it remained in being throughout the second half of the century, and indeed became a club whose membership, increasingly, proved that a state had been formally accepted as internationally sovereign. It had, by the nature of its constitution, no powers or resources independent of those assigned to it by member nations, and hence no powers of independent action. The sheer need for global coordination multiplied international organizations faster than ever in the crisis decades. By the mid-1980s, there were 365 intergovernmental ones and no less than 4,615 non-governmental ones, or more than twice as many as in the early 1970s. Moreover, global action on problems such as conservation and the environment was increasingly recognized to be urgent. However, unfortunately, the only formal procedures for achieving it, namely by international treaties separately signed and ratified by sovereign nation states, were slow, clumsy, and inadequate, as was demonstrated by the efforts to preserve the Antarctic continent and permanently to ban the hunting of whales. The very fact that in the 1980s the government of Iraq killed thousands of its citizens by poison gas, thus breaking one of the few genuinely universal international conventions, the Geneva Protocol of 1925, against the use of chemical warfare, underlined the weakness of available international instruments. Nevertheless, two ways of securing international action were available, and the crisis decades saw both substantially reinforced. One was the voluntary abdication of national power to supranational authorities by middle-sized states, which no longer felt strong enough to stand on their own in the world. The European Economic Community, renamed the European Community in the 1980s and the European Union in the 1990s, doubled its size in the 1970s and prepared to expand it even further in the 1990s, while reinforcing its authority over the affairs of its member states. The fact of this double extension was unquestionable, though it was to provoke considerable national resistance, both by member governments and public opinion in their countries. The strength of the community union lay in the fact that its unelected central authority in Brussels took independent policy initiatives and was virtually immune to the pressures of democratic politics, except very indirectly through the periodic meetings and negotiations of representatives of its elected member governments. This state of affairs enabled it to function as an effective supranational authority, subject only to specific vetoes. The other instrument of international action was equally, if not more, protected against nation states and democracies. This was the authority of the international financial bodies set up in the aftermath of the Second World War, mainly the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Backed by the oligarchy of the major capitalist countries, which, under the vague label of the Group of Seven, became increasingly institutionalized from the 1970s, they acquired increasing authority during the crisis decades as the uncontrollable vagaries of the global exchanges, debt crisis of the Third World, and after 1989, the collapse of the Soviet bloc economies made a growing number of countries dependent on the willingness of the rich world to grant them loans. These loans were increasingly made conditional on the local pursuit of economic policies agreeable to the global banking authorities. The triumph of neoliberal theology in the 1980s was, in effect, translated into policies of systematic privatization and free market capitalism, which were imposed on governments too bankrupt to resist them, whether they were immediately relevant to their economic problems or not, as in post-Soviet Russia. It is interesting, but alas pointless, to speculate on what J.M. Keynes and Harry Dexter White would have thought about this transformation of the institutions they had constructed with very different objects in mind, not least the object of full employment in their respective countries. Still, these were effective international authorities, at all events for the imposition of policies by the rich on the poor countries. At the end of the century, it remained to be seen what the consequences of these policies were and what their effects on world development would be. Two vast regions of the world were about to test them. One was the region of the USSR and its associated European and Asian economies, which, after the fall of the Western communist system, now lay in ruins. The other was the storehouse of social explosive which filled so much of the Third World. As we shall see in the next chapter, it had, since the 1950s, formed the major element of political instability on the globe.